Thank you very much, Jean, and thank you for the opportunity to present today. This report is a collaboration of myself and partners in the North Caucasus, from the Children's Hospital there, from the Medical Academy there, and then a few German surgeons that we work with. And we have no financial disclosures to make. Jean, as you already alluded to, I'm not a trained surgeon. So let me present to you the connection of our work and how public health potentially relates to global surgery based on our experiences with past disaster responses in Russia's North Caucasus, and based on our experiences of post-conflict knowledge and technology transfer in the context of surgical care delivery. I'm particularly interested in your input on our experience of mental health in post-conflict surgery, and I'm gonna present our anecdotal experience, very anecdotal experience with this complicated field, I think. And then I'll share a few thoughts on what the potential impact of the community of public health practitioners and researchers might be to global surgery. And again, I'm curious on your view on that, and what we think are potential elements of potentially sustainable partnerships and coalitions in that context. So just to set the stage, when the Soviet Union collapsed at the end of the 80s and beginning of the 90s, also what was previously a relatively well-funded and relatively stable health system collapsed also, which has particular implications for the periphery. And I circled here and read the Caucasian region, which for geopolitical reasons was particularly affected. So the Northern Caucasus consists of a series of small autonomous republics, which are part of the Russian Federation, but they have their own budget, which in turn is completely dependent on the central government in the Russian Federation. And then in the south, the former Soviet republics, which are now independent, Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. And the region is most notably known for the two Chechen wars. Chechnya is one of these republics trying to become independent, and with the end of that, with the official end of these conflicts last year, the violence has spread mainly to neighboring republics, notably Ingushetia and most recently to Dagestan. These are all, again, these autonomous, mostly Muslim republics in the Northern Caucasus. And we, our involvement was primarily taking care of these patients domestically, and this approach changed after the disaster in Beslan, where a group of terrorists took more than 1,300 children and their families hostage. It was a three-day siege, and at the end, it ended with extreme violence. And at the end, 334 victims were dead, more than half of them children. And as most of these hostages were held in a gym, there were a lot of survivors that had complex injuries from the blast wave of indoor bomb explosions. So there was a study by the WHO field offices in the region and the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm, which basically found that the immediate trauma response to the disaster was basically appropriate. But there was no government involvement addressing the mid and long-term consequences of this disaster in terms of medical and surgical issues. This was taken over, and it's not completely atypical for post-Soviet societies. This was addressed by women, by mothers who organized into mother committees and who advocated for the cause of the survivors. And as also typical for post-conflict, for post-Soviet countries, there is a primary and secondary care system that is in place and that works, but is typically outdated, and they don't offer subspecialties, no surgical subspecialties. So several years after the disaster was in 2004, in 2006, local faculty, health providers, and these mother committees approached us with the observation that many of the victims had developed complications, and many of these complications were ear-related. This is due to the fact that if the tympanic membrane is destroyed and does not heal spontaneously, then this leads to damaging of these small middle ear bones. And this is something that really requires technical expertise that's typically found in major centers. So we did what we had done for years. We collected funds and brought these patients abroad, which was difficult because it was difficult to find to select the right patients, bring them abroad, have them operated, and then it required a while of curing until they could be sent home. And it didn't address the unavailability of these services in the Caucasus. So we then shifted the focus of our activity really to the Caucasus itself and partnered the main stakeholders. And these were, of course, the hospital staff and faculties that were taking care of these patients. These were international health specialists, and in other words, surgeons who were actually capable to do these operations, and we found these in Germany. The local Ministry of Health is responsible for all health-related activities, and they report directly to the central government. So we needed their involvement for accreditation, for authorizations, etc. The local medical school has kind of a monopole over continuing medical education, so we had them on board. And again, we had these groups, mother committees, human rights groups, that helped us find these patients and approach them and get them access to care. So the goal of this coalition, if you want so, was to identify and address the needs that had arisen years after the disaster and start building capacity by equipping the health facilities that were present and by training surgeons. So the advantage, unlike in low-income countries, the advantage for mid-income countries is that you actually have structures that exist and that you can build on. So our strategy was to basically share the jobs within that group of stakeholders. And that meant strategic and administrative planning, getting access to the patients, identifying them, getting them into care, and also making sure that they have high quality follow-up, which is very important in surgery, that they get post-operative care. And it also helped to clarify what each of the stakeholders had to expect from each other. And again, not atypical for post-Soviet health system, there's not much communication between stakeholders. In other words, it's very siloed. So for example, the pediatric surgeons would not necessarily communicate with adult surgeons. So this was one example of opportunities for improvement in management and leadership within this health system. And it also helped us address security concerns. So bringing international folks into an area where there's a travel ban for international staff for international organizations, for example, was something that we basically addressed by in the preparatory stages by going extremely under the radar, just preparing everything internally. And once we were on site, this approach was not longer feasible just by word of mouth. So we had a lot of people involved to make sure that these security concerns were addressed. And the first step in preparation was a needs assessment from the supply side of things. So there is an OR that's important for surgery to operate on, and there is some equipment that even at the end of perestroika would have been outdated. So there were actually a whole variety of things that were available. Anesthesia is typically not available in low-income countries. Sterilizing equipment, all the equipment and supplies that you need for basic surgery, and then for the specialized operations, we needed to fill these gaps with more specialized supplies and equipment. And then the next step was to really incorporate best surgical practices into local care, and that meant that we had to train a North Ossetian surgeon abroad, because These kinds of operations, as I said, are typically done in major centers. And the purpose was to train this surgeon to identify suitable patients, to coordinate the existing services in Ossetia in preparation of then bringing in the international surgeons, and to learn how to follow up these patients. So establishing a surgical program means basically three steps. It means appropriate patient selection. They cannot be pregnant. They have to be able and willing to be operated on. Then doing the actual surgery is one step. And the post-operative care, as I said, is not less important because it can ruin your whole result. Here I just want to point your attention to two numbers. So we've two years after the disaster, we found that there were at least 19 persons who needed specialized operations, and we were able to identify 10 of these. Now, if you look at the medical or surgical results of these of this mission, 15 operations were done. The results were fairly well. So if you compare this internationally, for example, with what the American military does in Southern America, it's comparable. We had a few cases of reperforation, which is kind of the bad outcome that you want to avoid, two in Beslan victims and one in a non-disaster-related patient. And then I talked about capacity building. It's a little bit ambitious to talk about capacity building if you just start to train surgeons in a process that takes years. But this process was started. We were able to equip one operation rooms. And if you look at the cost, this was done at about $1,500 per patient, which is high if you compare it to the typical global health interventions. But it included these specialized training and equipment. But what's interesting is that, as I said, among the 19 victims that we knew of that needed care, we were able to get a hold of 10 victims. So it means that that not even half of the patients that we actually operated on were post-conflict disaster victims. And the reason for that is something that has been observed in war surgery also. The first reason is emergencies. So ear disease can actually kill. There are some emergencies that need to be addressed immediately. So if you establish a surgical program for these purposes, there are not only elective but emergency operations to do. The other phenomenon is that you find advanced pathology that you would typically not find if the health system works appropriately. So this adolescent, for example, is someone who had chronic middle ear infections and complications from that, and that would be something that in other settings would have long been operated on. So our conclusion was that you need to do needs assessment on a repetitive basis, because the question is, do conflicts increase or modify disease burden, as I just showed? And even if the immediate response is appropriate, or sometimes even inappropriate, this can change, particularly in a post-conflict setting, over time. And then the other question is, do conflicts limit the availability of or access to health services? And here is a possible explanation why we only operated on less than a third of those patients that we had identified. So if you look at this woman's face, you see that she is not very happy. She's not very happy that she now finally has the opportunity to be operated on. And we learned later from an Italian group that assessed these survivors psychologically that, of course, this disaster had a strong impact on the psychological well-being of victims, of their caregivers and their families, and that this disaster impacted the reorganization of their family lives and their community ties. And this is particularly true for these small countries that are very traditional, very archaic cultures, where coping strategies are deeply rooted in traditions of everyday life. So these are basically children who are brought up in traditions, respect for the elderly, differences, the typical gender role differences. And this is something that we knew had been early addressed by international organizations and domestic. Caritas Russia, for example, did psychosocial work with the survivors. And when we designed our surgical interventions, that was something that was beyond our capacity and expertise to address, basically. But it is part of the public health framework for conflict and violence that daily stresses of life in a post-conflict society with ongoing violence certainly constitutes a barrier to treatment and also to surgical treatment. So there were, even speaking of capacity buildings, there are a variety of unmet needs, poor infrastructure, as I said, a sufficient number of health professionals, again, a difference to low-income countries, but they're inadequately trained. A recent study found that Russia has the highest number of operation rooms per population, but only one-third has the availability, but a third lacks the availability of basic monitoring for safe and quality operations. So, for example, this is the anesthesiologist, and instead of having monitoring that tells him the vital signs of the patients, he has a stethoscope and his finger on the pulse or during the operation. It's something that really impacts the quality of the surgery and the safety for them. And here is what the public health community can contribute to surgery. So the Global Burden of Disease study that was already cited today found that 11% of global deaths are attributed to surgical disease. And that the two billion people that worldwide lack access to surgery are not even included in those that have this kind of basic surgical access. So what's the value of operating 15 patients in mediocre circumstances? The value really is that this is the entry strategy to improve quality care and through this horizontal surgical mission strengthen the whole local health system. And I'm going to show, so this illustrates the role of ear surgery. More than 250 million people, or 4% of the global population, have disabling hearing impairment. And the vast majority of these live in low and middle income countries, and they don't have the means to afford hearing aids. So this means, we didn't even speak about prevention, but that would be the next contribution from a public health standpoint of view. So the limitations of these short-term volunteer surgical missions are really, they have some, and given the acuity of things, they have some value immediately, but it's really the integration into the whole health system that brings the real value of that. Given the security situation in the North Caucasus, it's very difficult to get funding where funders cannot verify the success of the mission. And the next problem is that the same as in low-income countries. If you train health professionals abroad, what do you do about the drained brain? And we are now in the phase of, again, joining senior surgeons there, the medical school, and the health ministry to address these issues. So we think that mid-income countries provide the unique opportunity of available secondary care that you can build on. Partnering international with local stakeholders, including human rights groups, can create credible partnerships and provide access to vulnerable populations. Needs assessment need to be done periodically to facilitate a meaningful transition from humanitarian aid to development. And again, the complex issue of mental health that needs to be addressed as a barrier to healthcare seeking, probably. And the true value of these short-term humanitarian mission is probably in integrating quality surgical trainings and infrastructure into the broader health systems. Thank you very much.